Well, good morning, everyone. On a beautiful, sunny Sabbath day. When I walk in here, everybody always asks, how was your ride? And it was just fabulous. About a third of the way here, you hit the hills and the radio stations of Buffalo start to crackle and fade out. And I had a CD in and I'd listened to that earlier in the week. So the car just went quiet and the hum of the road and thinking through the message and all. And it was a very peaceful, very enjoyable ride up here. So thank you for asking and thank you for having me. I bring greetings certainly from everybody in Buffalo and from one of your daughters or sisters here. Marilyn Kelly has relocated to Buffalo, so we grieve for your loss, but we're certainly happy to have her in Buffalo and her smiling face always. So we're trying to figure out what to have her help with to keep her busy. Always helps to have extra hands. Well, I don't have any truck driver jokes. I'll make one brief reference to them somewhere in the message maybe, but I did have something that a friend from Texas sent, and I thought was really cute, so I thought I'd start with this. And it's called a different drug problem. I don't know if any of you have seen this on email. It says, editor's note, the following letter has appeared on the internet and was viewed by many readers. Many felt it would be appropriate for the readers of one of the parishes. So I don't know if this is from Texas or Louisiana or whatever, but it says, the other day, someone at a store in our town read that a methamphetamine lab had been found in an old farmhouse in the adjoining county, and he asked me a rhetorical question. Why didn't we have a drug problem when you and I were growing up? I replied, I had a drug problem when I was young. I was drugged to church on Sunday, Saturday morning. I was drugged to church for weddings and funerals. I was drugged to family reunions and community socials, no matter the weather. I was drugged by my ears when I was disrespectful to parents. I was also drugged to the woodshed when I disobeyed my parents, told a lie, brought home a bad report card, did not speak with respect, spoke ill of the teacher or the preacher, or if I didn't put forth my best effort in anything that was asked of me. I was drugged to the kitchen sink to have my mouth washed out with soap if I uttered a profanity. I was drugged out to pull weeds in mom's garden and flower beds and cockle burrs out of dad's fields. I was drugged to the homes of family, friends, and neighbors to help out some poor soul who had no one to mow the yard, repair the clothesline, or chop some firewood. And if my mother had ever known that I took a single dime as a tip for this kindness, she would have drugged me back to the woodshed. Those drugs are still in my veins, and they affect my behavior in everything I do, say, or think. They are stronger than cocaine, crack, or heroin. And if today's children had this kind of drug problem, America would be a better place. God bless the parents who drugged us. Christina Brooks, sent that to me just recently, and I thought it was cute. You know, we look at the things that created us, the things that are at our core, and we recognize sometimes that the things that didn't seem so fun, that didn't seem so helpful at the time, have really crafted who we are and the character that we have today. I was beginning to get nervous that Mr. Stachina was going to use my entire sermon today. As we started singing hymns, he was using many of the psalms, many of the scriptures in the particular hymns that we'll cover today. And matter of fact, three of the five so far, and you could stretch it to four, that he's used today. So we'll touch base on those. I appreciate they're always a nice introduction to weave back into the message. But I already said good morning, and so now I'll tell you all that we're going to have a pop quiz today. Doesn't that make your veins run a little cold? You remember that in school when the teacher announced that as you walked in and settled into your class? But don't worry, there's only one question, and you can answer it in the privacy of your own mind, so nobody needs to know whether you were successful in coming up with the right answer or not. Here's the question. What is the official motto of the Republic of Nicaragua? I see some nervous faces out there. So I'll give you a hint. It's also the motto of the state of Florida. I see a couple of smiles now, but no lights going off. Try this. It's the official national motto of the United States of America. In God We Trust was adopted as the official motto of the United States in 1956 by President Eisenhower. And by law, it is now required to be on all our coins and currency in this great nation. In 2006, on the 50th anniversary of its adoption, the Senate reaffirmed In God We Trust as an official national motto of the United States of America. Now, critics contend that having it on our currency and having that supported by the government conflicts with the First Amendment. And others simply say, I read through some various articles as I started to develop the message, that the motto has run its course and it's of no use. It means nothing. It falls on deaf ears. Down through time, this statement has been a battle cry for many groups and many activities, many battles. But if it's such a recurring theme, why is the world so out of touch with this motto, In God We Trust? If the law of our land gives it a prominent place in everyone's lives, in our pocketbooks, why is it so distinctly absent from the everyday lives of our citizens? Brethren, do we, as God's people, trust in God? I don't know if you've asked yourself that question, if it may have crossed your mind, if you even recognize as you pull out bills and you do the commerce that you do, and we all do, if you take the time from time to time to look at the back of most of those bills and recognize that it's even there. Do you, do I, do we as God's people trust in God? Let's begin by turning to the book of Proverbs. Proverbs and Psalms, we cover this concept of trust quite often. Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 5 is our first verse this morning. Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 5 tells us to trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. Verse 6 continues, in all your ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct your paths. So that's pretty straightforward. It's a recommendation, it's a direction, it's an instruction given as from a father to a son. Or a teacher to a student. Pretty straightforward. Trust in God. Acknowledge him in all your ways. Look to him in the daily transactions of your life, in the thoughts of your heart, in the words of your mouth, and he will guide you. He will lead you. He will direct you. He will bless you. We need to consider that question. I asked it earlier, and I'll come back to it again and again. Do we trust God in all the aspects of our lives? There are some big, hairy, big, fat, hairy moments that we face in our lives. And we'll go through a couple of examples in the message today like that. And those are times when our palms go moist and our heart beats faster and our breath becomes a little bit shallow perhaps. But there are little things. There are daily things that we need to recognize that, you know, our faith, our trust in God is not something that we lock deep down inside, you know, like putting on a shelf or in the safe in your basement. And then live life on our own terms. Before we go any farther, let's make sure that we understand the question or the basis of the question. The definition for the word trust says an assured reliance on the character, ability, strength, or truth of someone or something. And of course, our specific question here today is whether we trust in God. So again, the assured reliance on the character, ability, strength, or truth of someone or something. The Hebrew word here is batach, B-A-T-A-C-H, batach. It's a fairly rich word. It has to do with security, with quietness, with peace. It talks about being a refuge, and the concordance gives us the sense that having trust, trusting in something, has the ability to dispel anxiety. It has the ability to settle our concerns and our worries. Psalm chapter 18 and verse 2. Psalm chapter 18 and verse 2 talks about trust and talks about what it can give us, what it can do for us in a time of need. Psalm chapter 18 and verse 2. It said, "The Lord is my rock and my fortress." One of the songs we sang just talked about this. "My rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God, my strength, in whom I will trust. My buckler or shield," so in a time of attack, it's something to shield yourself with, "the horn of my salvation and my high tower." So again, it talks about a rock, a fortress, a high tower. Those are things of refuge. Those are things of security, protection, and peace. They can dispel anxiety. I already mentioned the word faith, and it has a similar meaning, and yet I'm going to try to some degree to differentiate them because I think there is a different. One is larger, one is sometimes to us, I think, more abstract. And one, here's my reference to the truck driver, is really where trust is where the rubber meets the road. Trust is the thing that we do on a daily basis. Trust is the thing that we reach for when we have a moment, a specific situation where we feel that anxiety and we need it to be dispelled. So again, you may look at it later and say, okay, Rigord, you're splitting hairs. But what I'm trying to recognize, and we'll go through a couple of them, it is that faith and trust, although similar, also are somewhat different. Faith, if you do a look up in the concordance, there's like 220 references in Scripture. And there's 125 in trust. There's a difference. The word faith is pistis, P-I-S-T-I-S, whereas trust is batak, and it has a slightly different application, a slightly different meaning. Let me try to explain. Faith, the way I try to understand it or the way I feel it, faith is big. Faith is at our very core. It's the foundation of our beliefs. And in fact, the word faith is very often translated into the word believe or to believe. Most of you, I'm sure, can quote the definition of faith from Hebrews chapter 11, and we'll turn there in a few moments. Again, the word faith, if you look it up in the concordance, means a moral conviction regarding religious truth. A moral conviction. This is a deep down belief in religious truth, especially a reliance upon Christ for salvation. And it also describes it using the words assurance, which we saw in the definition for trust, belief, and to believe. So again, faith, there is some cross-reference here, but I'm going to try to separate them as well. Again, I don't want to make too big a deal of this, but let me try to explain. I believe, and I expect that we all feel very similar when we use different words, but I believe that God is. And yet I have never met him face to face. I believe that the Bibles that are in our laps are the inspired word of God, and yet I have never met one of the authors, nor looked into their face in a moment where they had that divine inspiration and started to scribble their notes. I believe in God's promise that if I die in the faith at Christ's return, I will be resurrected and I will live eternally in God's kingdom. But I've never met somebody that went through that process. These things, I believe these things. I have faith in God's promises because he opened my mind, he opened my heart, and he poured some degree of his Holy Spirit into it. And because of that gift, I accept these things. I believe these things inside. To me, that's faith. That's how I see that. Let's turn to Hebrews chapter 11 for a moment to cement that, if you will, or to support that. Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 1, turn there if you like, we'll be there just for the definition really, and again, most of you can quote it verbatim. Hebrews chapter 11 verse 1, it says, now faith is the substance of things hoped for, hope, something future, something that I hold inside me, something I've heard, something that has been promised to me, something that I hold to be true at some point, I have hope for, the evidence of things not seen, and I talked to you about the fact, I have not seen the authors of the Bible. I have not seen God face to face, and yet I believe in these things. Trust, on the other hand, in my mind, is more tangible. Not that faith is not, but again, trust is more tangible, more active, kind of where the rubber meets the road, as I mentioned. It's something that we do in a moment when we need to. It's something we call on and reach for when we have a certain amount of stress or a certain amount of pressure. Trust is something that must be built. It's developed. You know, you can't, when you walk up to a person, call me a cynic if you will, but when you walk up to a person and you've never met them before, I don't inherently trust somebody. I've heard people say that. Well, I have faith in the inherent goodness of man. That can get you dead. I don't have faith in the inherent character of an individual that I have not had a relationship with. I haven't come to understand them. What did it say earlier? It talked about character. It talked about ability. And those are things that I and you and we come to see, come to learn, come to understand, come to believe in and trust in when we have a relationship with somebody or something. I told you earlier that I believe in God, but I have never seen him. On the other hand, I have come to trust him because I have seen his work in my life. I have seen him turn the heart of an employer in my favor. I have seen situations where
I very well could have been injured very severely, and I have seen that protection in my life. I've seen the rules and the rewards and the punishments sometimes that God has promised come to play in my life. I have given and received love as a parent, and to some degree I better understand the relationship between God and His Son. And I believe that each of you can look into the pages of your life and see Him at work as well. Again, it's through the interaction that we come to understand and gain confidence in God in the daily transactions of our lives. We know, we understand, we read the promises, and we believe, we come to trust that He will intervene when we need it, that He'll guide our steps, as we sang earlier, even if it's not always the way that we hope it'll play out. Our plans aren't always His, but I've come to trust Him, and I know all of us have come to trust to some degree. So the dollar bill, our currency, say, in God we trust. Have we come to trust in God because of the relationship that we have developed with Him? When we read, when we pray, when we fast, when we study, we develop, we talk to and hear from God. And I hope that you can boldly and quickly answer yes to that question. I'd like to move into two well-known Bible stories today to look at this subject of trusting God when we're under pressure. Both of the characters we'll look at here had close relationships with God. There's no question about their faith, their belief in Him, their understanding of who He is and what He does. But we're going to look at a particular stories in their lives where the stress was pretty hot and they needed to trust in the outcome of God intervening in their lives. First, we'll look at the life of David. If we turn to the book of Psalms, and I mentioned that a number of the hymns that we've sung today already came out of the Psalms, many of them were written by King David, and we find this notion of trusting in God constantly throughout Psalms. As I mentioned, trust is mentioned 125 times, depending on which version you're looking through the concordance of. And the vast majority of those will either say, trust in God, or trust not in this, but rather in God. And so almost every single one of those 125 refer to trust being in God. And that is the basis, the foundation, the unchanging core on which we trust. And if you review the life of David, if anybody learned to trust in God, it would have been David. You can look at the numerous times that his life hung by a thread. You can look at the rebellions within his own family. You can look at, Saul chasing after him all those miles and all those months. He came to learn to understand the meaning of the word trust. The first hymn we sang today came out of Psalm 25. If you turn to Psalm 25, we're going to read the first three verses here. Psalm chapter 25. And here David's talking. Psalm chapter 25 and verse 1. He said, "To you, O Eternal, I lift up my soul. O my God, I trust in you. Let me not be ashamed, and let not my enemies triumph over me. Indeed, let no one who waits on you be ashamed." So David calls out in this particular situation, and whether it was in preparation for something or whether it was in reference to something, I didn't follow the context for this specifically, but he's saying to God, "God, I trust in you. And I lift my life to you because I have come to trust. I have seen you work," I believe we'll cover it in others, "I have seen you work throughout my life from the days of my youth to that as an older man, as a king of Israel. I have seen you work in my life and I have come to trust you, and I present my life in that attitude of trust to you." David had come to the point in his life, to this level of understanding and trusting unequivocally in God, because he had walked with God, and he had talked with God. And he knew with every fiber of his being that he had come to understand that he could depend on God in any situation. I mentioned that a couple of the Bible stories are what we're going to go through today, and let's turn to an earlier time in David's life. Let's turn back to the book of 1 Samuel, and we'll read an extended section of chapter 17. 1 Samuel chapter 17. And when we get into this, you'll very quickly recognize the story. going to read through, starting in 1 and going up to verse 50, basically. And so, as not to bog down here, I'm going to move rather quickly through certain sections of this. I'm going to bounce through the various verses. And sometimes we'll slow down and we'll look at the details because I believe they're pertinent in helping us to understand the scope of something or the size of something or just how incredible something would have been. Again, we can often read through these stories and we understand them in our mind, but when we slow down and we really savor the details sometimes, it helps us to really understand better what's being said and sometimes get the nuances of even multiple messages being provided to us here. So again, in 1 Samuel 17 and verse 1, it says, "Now the Philistines gathered together their armies to battle." And again, the story is lengthy, so I'm going to jump through here. And it says in verse 2 that Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together against them. Verse 3 says, "So the Philistines stood on a mountain on one side, and Israel stood on a mountain on the other side, and there was a valley between them." So again, as you start to hear the story and you start to create this picture in your mind, and you start to see the details and the dates and the characters and how they all come together, you create the depth or the wealth of the story here. Verse 4, "And there went out a champion from the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span." Now a cubit is the distance between your elbow and the point of your finger. And generally it's recognized as about 18 inches. So, you know, it starts to give you an idea. So he's 6 cubits and a span. And a span is the space between the tip of your thumb and the tip of your baby finger, and which is typically about 9 inches. So depending on the size of the individual, and if we settle somewhere close to the 18 inches and 9 inches, we're talking that Goliath would have stood about 10 and a half foot tall. So if you again picture this in your mind and take an average human male, and someone who's rather sturdy, we can look at Mr. Bornia and say, okay, if you were to take Mark and you were to expand him to a height of 10 and a half foot, you're not simply stretching that individual. If I were 10 foot 6 tall, but I was my build, I'd look rather gangly and rather incompetent. But Goliath was 10 foot 6 tall, and you realize that he's going to be twice the thickness of a human being and twice the width of a typical person, 10 foot 6. So the recommendation is, or the idea is, he probably went between 800 and 900 pounds. And he was their champion, and therefore he was muscled, he was very capable. I mean, this was one solid dude. So, as I said, I'll sometimes slow down and give you the ideas, the details here, because as we weave through the story and we recognize the trust that was required, we need to recognize the challenge that was there and what it would have done to our heart. Put ourselves in these couple of stories, and what would our heart, what would our trust, what would our confidence level have been? And then we more richly understand the story here. Okay, so we've talked a little bit about Goliath and his size. Verse 5 goes on, and it said he had a helmet of brass upon his head. And you've all seen, you know, the gladiator-type movies and all, and so you can imagine the armor that they're wearing. And then again, multiply that to the size of this individual. A helmet of brass upon his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail. Again, you've seen the, you know, King Arthur's court, and you see the chain mail that they wear in order to stop spears or swords or something like that from piercing. And the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of brass. Again, to give you a basis here, that coat of mail, which was only part of his armor, weighed 125 pounds. 125 pounds, just a piece of the armor. Okay? Verse 7, "And the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam." Again, what is a weaver's beam? I don't know if any of you have seen one up close, but if you were to take a baseball bat, take the thick end of a baseball bat in your hand, maybe, you know, 3 to 4 inches around. That gives you the general concept of the size of this weaver's beam. That's his spear handle. And if he's 10 foot tall, you know, if I have a spear, it's probably going to be higher than me. So we're looking at a beam that's probably the size of a baseball bat, and it's 10 to 12 foot long. Again, you start to understand, you know, this individual's got to be on his knees even to be in this room. Very impressive. "And the spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron." So that's 15 to 20 pounds is the spearhead that sits on the end of this thing. Let's move on to verse 8, and it says, "And he stood and he cried unto the armies of Israel." So he presented his challenge. You've got armies on one side, armies on the other, and he troops down into the central area, and he throws his challenge out. He defies the armies of Israel. Verse 10, "And the Philistine said, I defy the army of Israel this day to give me a man that we may fight together." The concept was, instead of all this headache and everything else, out of fear, they send their, well, out of confidence, they send their greatest, and it instills fear in the men of Israel. So verse 11 says, "When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid." Again, we looked at the detail earlier so that we could better understand what would have been before the eyes of these warriors of Israel, and how it was that it, you know, set their heart a twitter, what they faced. Continuing in verse 13, it says, "And the three eldest sons of Jesse went and followed Saul to the battle." So of his eight sons, Jesse's eight sons, the three eldest were serving in the army, and they were there with Saul. Verse 14, it says, "And David was the youngest," so the youngest of these eight, and we know that he was back acting as the shepherd, taking care of the family flocks. Picking it up again in verse 16, and it says, "And the Philistine drew near morning and evening and presented himself for 40 days. So morning and evening, day in and day out, Goliath came before and presented his challenge, berating Israel and their God. Meanwhile, back home, Jesse says to David, "Here, take some supplies and go see the troops. Go talk to your brothers. Let's find out what's happening at the battle site." And so David made his plans, and he made sure that he had a keeper for the flocks, and he gathered up all the supplies that his father had prepared, and he made the trip. Again in verse 23, "And after David arrived and began to speak to the soldiers, there came again the champion Goliath, and he issued his challenge as he had day and night. And as always, the men of Israel drew back, and David saw this." So one of the first things, he gets there, he says hello, he delivers his stuff, he starts to talk to people, how are things going, and he sees this sight. And then he watches the men that are his heroes effectively cower from this Philistine. And David can hardly believe it. Verse 26, it says, he asked a question. He's appalled. He's offended. He said, "Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" Again, we can recall earlier as we watched over and over the challenge come and the men cower or withdraw, there's a drought of bravery here among Israel. And yet this young man makes the challenge. He asks the question. His older brother even hollered at him, saying, "Shut up, keep quiet. I know you're just here. You just want to see the show." And so he berated his little brother. But his words, David's words, his words of trust and bravery and boldness didn't fall on deaf ears. In all that silence of bravery, this young man's words found their way to the ears of the king. Verse 31, "And Saul sent for him." So again, they're on the road, they're set up in their tents, they're arrayed against the Philistine army, and they're very uncertain at this point, very unconfident, and Saul sends for David. And in verse 32, we hear a little bit of the conversation, and we know that David offers to fight the Philistine. And Saul says in verse 33, "You can't fight against this monster. Just look at him. Did you see him? I know you heard the challenge, but did you see this guy? You're only a boy, and he's a seasoned warrior." But David goes on to tell the king, imagine the setting here again. You've got David, is he 12? Is he 15? I don't know for sure. I don't remember if we're specifically told, but it says that he's a boy. He's the youngest of the boys, and he's sitting here before King Saul, and he tells the stories about how he saved his sheep from the bear and the lion. As I read through these particular verses, it reminds me that as a very young boy, maybe I was 5 or 6 years old, my family had an album. It starts to age you, doesn't it, when you say an album? You know, the old vinyl. And it was Bible stories set to music. And I wore that thing out. I loved that album. And if any of you are particularly good at finding old recordings, I'd love to have some help, because I'd love to find it again for my children, because I haven't heard that in probably 40 years, and yet those lyrics come back to me in my mind. If I can get my nerves down. You know, I can talk to you guys, but when I start singing, I get nervous. So you can throw tomatoes if you need, but it says here, Bible tells how a boy named David played the harp and loved to sing. Saved his sheep from the bear and the lion, brave little boy and shepherd king. So, you know, it took you through the bear and the lion, and here's David before the king telling the story of the bear and the lion and how he saved his sheep. Let's look a little closer at what we've seen so far out of David. So David arrives, he hears the challenge of Goliath. We're just summarizing here, because we begin to see the faith of David. He says, who is this uncircumcised Philistine that would challenge our God and our men? Rather than shrink from it as everyone else had, including his brothers, we immediately learn of his commitment to God. So we begin to see the faith of David in who God is and how he plays a part in his life and how it's not right that he be challenged. Again, he's offended and appalled at the disrespect of his foreigner to challenge Israel and their God. And in a moment here, David shows the strength of his character. Remember, it said earlier about trust comes from understanding the character and the ability or the truth of someone or something. In a moment here, we see David show the strength of his character by giving God credit for the things he has accomplished so far in his life. Because in verse 37, let's pick up the story again. In verse 37, David goes on to tell the king, after telling him about the, you know, when the bear came upon us, and he took one of my lambs away in his teeth, I chased him down, and with my sling, I killed the bear, and I took back that lamb. He said, the Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine. David makes it clear to King Saul that he trusts in God because he's seen God's deliverance in his life. We talked earlier about the faith, the fact of, I know who God is, I've been taught of him, I heard of him and read of him all my life, but I've seen the traction that he gets. I've seen the protection and the blessing in the different transactions and specific challenges of my life. And here David recognized, and he's telling this to Saul. And Saul said, okay. In verse 39, so Saul's men try to outfit David with the armor. Well, if we're going to send you out there, we're going to give you the best fighting chance that you can. But David says unto Saul, he says, I cannot go with these, for I have not proven them. They've not been tried. They've not been proven them. I don't trust in these. I've not seen them. I've not wielded them. I'm not comfortable with them. I don't trust them. In 2 Samuel chapter 22, 31, just to make this particular point about being proven or tried, 2 Samuel chapter 22 and verse 31, it says, as for God, his way is perfect. The word of the Lord is tried or proven. He is a buckler or a shield to them that trust in him. So if you've had God work in your life, if you've called on those promises and confidently made the decisions and moved forward, you trust that those promises will play out next time as they have in the past. David had no confidence in the armor. The sword may have been very, very capable in the hands of someone else, but David hadn't tried them. He hadn't proved them. He hadn't experienced them, and therefore he didn't trust them. He knew what he was capable of in God's hands, but he was not going to put his trust in anything else. Continuing in verse 40, and he took his staff in his hand, and he chose 5 smooth stones out of the brook, and he had his sling in his hand as well, and he drew near to the Philistine. And we know in the ensuing verses, you know, that Goliath was shocked to see this little boy approaching. You know, if you look at that 12 or 15-year-old boy, they're not filled out. They're physically not complete yet. And so this monster of a guy who had so much armor and equipment that he needed a shield bearer to carry part of it for him sees this gangly young shepherd boy coming out with nothing but a wooden staff in his hand. He probably couldn't see the sling or that. He sees this little broom handle in his hand. And he's offended. And he starts to mock him and he starts to berate him and he talks about that. What is this? I'm going to feed you to the birds, boy. And when he's done, we hear David's response. And in verse 45, it says, and then David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield. You come to me with your weapons of mass destruction and you come with your show of strength and shock and awe. But I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts and the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day, verse 46, will the Lord deliver you into my hand, Basically, I will have your head, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. So David has the faith, he has the belief, and now he stands on the battlefield before their champion. And here again is the difference that I make, is here is where trust kicks in. Here is where he has seen God work in his life before. He's faced the bear, he's faced the lion, he's faced very formidable foes before. And he has seen God's blessing, and he trusts in it. Then David, verse 49, and David took a stone and slung it and smote the Philistine in his forehead. Verse 50, so David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone, all the time trusting in God and giving God credit for that success, for that victory. Brethren, when we face the challenges in our lives, whatever they may be, do we trust in God? Have we built a relationship over time? Have we read and studied and asked and prayed for and called for and then seen the answers? Can we boldly call upon his promises for deliverance and then securely make that decision? I hope that you can quickly and boldly answer yes. Psalm chapter 71 and verse 5. Again, we've looked at a story from David's youth. We recognize that as a king, as more mature, more experienced, he had come to trust in God because he had hidden in caves, vastly outnumbered, and he had seen some very specific challenges in his life, and God had delivered them from all, or him from all of them. It says, Psalm chapter 71 and verse 5, it says, "For you are my hope, O Lord God, you are my trust from my youth." So we looked at something from David's youth, and we see that he saw the benefits of God. He saw the trust built over time. Psalm 37 and verse 25, I referred to this earlier. It says, "I have been young and now I am old. So as I look back through the years of my life and the battles that I have waged, I have been young and now I'm old, and I have not seen the righteous forsaken, nor his descendants begging bread. Father, I have come to trust in you." There are many stories from the life of David, and when you think about it, trust between David and God is one of the central themes of his life. The second story I'd like to cover today is that of Daniel in the lion's den. It's another tale of enduring faith, and yet at the specific challenge, at the moment in time, there was active trust during that time of stress. Turn to Daniel chapter 6. And I'm going to approach it much the same way. We're going to cover several verses here, and so I'll bounce back and forth, cover some of the highlights. Daniel chapter 6 and verse 1. Again, our question is, our theme is, our title for today is, "In God We Trust." Do we? In the big, fat, hairy, scary situations of our lives, and in the daily transactions where we know we're just not in total control of the surroundings. It can be an employer, it can be an irritable neighbor, it can be an erratic driver in front of us. Do we trust in God? Do we call in his name and his promises and trust him through thick and thin? Daniel chapter 6 and verse 1. "It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps or princes to be over the whole kingdom." So if you, again, start to create this mental picture and you see a kingdom, and you know, it's not just a castle on a hill with some serfs and some people with some fields in front. He's got 120 princes. So assume that maybe each one of these princes is over a significant city, the size of Elmira and all the surrounding suburbs, or Buffalo and all its suburbs. So you start to get the idea of the scope of what this kingdom, this rulership must have been. 120 princes to be over the whole kingdom. Verse 2, "And over these," so now we start to see how his structure was set up, because he couldn't possibly run to and fro and manage 120 people and all the transactions and details and funds and needs. "Over these, three governors," or presidents, it can be also translated, "of whom Daniel was one." We can look at the life of Daniel and we can see the blessings that he has seen. We can see the challenges that he had faced. We can see the trying and the proving of him as a young man that God had done. The fire and the sharpening stone that had been active in Daniel's life and had brought him to now a prominent place, a successful place, recognized by others because of the blessings that God had done in his life so far. Verse 3, and Daniel distinguished himself above all the others so that the king considered setting him over the whole realm. Well, this little detail didn't set well with some of those other presidents and princes. At least some of those thought that perhaps they should have been in charge instead. So this jealous little group of wannabe rulers decides that they're going to trip Daniel up. But they look very hard and realize the only way to do that is to trump something up. And the only soft spot that Daniel has is God. They weren't above playing that game. Verse 6, so the governors and the satraps thronged before the king. Again, if you look at the word throng before the king. So, you know, this wasn't some quiet little conference that somebody tried to do to set Daniel up. They came in all their pomp and ceremony. Oh, King Darius, live forever. You're the greatest. And what they did was they started that schmoozing. They started that honey and that sweetness that just, it puffed out the chest of Darius. And he started to think perhaps a little more highly of himself than he should. Again, it says they went on to say that they had this wonderful idea that King Darius should make a law that people can only worship him. Or they'll be thrown into the lion's den. And again, and we can look in verse 9, and King Darius allowed himself to feel a little self-important, and he signed the written decree. Let's get down to the meat of the story now, and we begin reading in verse 10. It says, now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home. So again, this was nothing covert, nothing done on the side. They had crafted this law, and they had put it out there very publicly, and they had their whole team of attorneys look at it very specifically to make sure that there were no outs, and they had it publicly set so that there was no way to turn it around. And it refers to the laws of the Medes and the Persians that it could not be gone back on. There was no changing, no fixing, no going back on it. So Daniel knew this, and Daniel knew that the writing was signed. He went home, and in his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees three times a day, and he prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. And we already referred to the early days of Daniel and how he had come to know God and to study and to read and to pray and to understand and to see God active in his life. Some translations describe this as a roof room. You know, it says in his upper room. So there was some degree of privacy here, but Daniel had the windows open. He wasn't trying to hide anything. Then verse 11 goes on to say, then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. So I picture this little gaggle of self-important men. You know, they're maybe on the roof across the street. You know, like some bad CIA agents. You know, they're all over there and they're looking. It's like, yeah, there he is again. There he is again. Cool. All right, this is working. You come to like these guys less and less with each verse, you know, as you go through it. You realize just how slippery these guys are, you know, recognizing that they didn't come out on top, so they were going to somehow get back on them, and they crafted it. We don't know how long this took, but they took the time to get everybody on board, cover their tracks, make everything right, and lock it up nice and tight. Verse 12, so now with their trumped up charges and their law in place, they take the case before the king. And it says, and they went before the king and spoke concerning the king's decree. Now again, seeing how slippery these guys are, know that they don't come straight out and make their charge. Again, recognize here what they say. Have you not signed a decree that every man who petitions any god or any man within 30 days except you, O king, shall be cast into the lion's den? So they're trying to back him into a corner here. Did you not sign this law, right? I mean, as I understand it, this is what we're dealing with, right? And because they had done such a good job, that was indeed true. And the king answered and said, this thing is true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. So he reconfirmed to them the fact that, yeah, you guys had this wonderful little idea. I liked it. I'm very happy with it. And we signed it and sealed it. It's all set. Yep, there's no going back on this. Verse 13. So they answered and said before the king, ha! Wait a minute, no. That Daniel, this captive of the Jew, captives from Judah, does not show due regard for you, O king, or for the decree that you have signed, but he makes his petitions three times a day to his God. And the king, when he heard these words, verse 14, was greatly displeased with himself. Notice, he didn't get upset with them. he immediately noticed his shortfall. He realized that he had been goaded into making this law. He began to see their scheme play out in the clarity now of the light of the situation. And it says, and he set. So Darius immediately recognized what was going on, and it says, and he set his heart on Daniel to deliver him, and he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver them. So he got his own bunch of attorneys, and he looked at every possible nook and cranny, every loophole that might be available, because he knew that that Daniel was righteous and that this was a setup. But there was nothing that could be done. The law had been crafted with very specific intent to ensnare Daniel, and they had been successful in their plan. Verse 16, so the king gave the command, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. But the king spoke, saying to Daniel, your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you. So the story plays out, and again, we talk about Daniel, we talk about his development, we talk about his years of experience, we talk about the strength of his faith and the development that God had done within his life to put him in this particular situation. And the faith that Daniel had kept him strong through all of those stories in his life. I keep wanting to say David and Daniel, we're certainly dealing with Daniel here. But trust, as I mentioned, is something that we reach for and embrace in a moment of need. It's something that's developed over time. And here's where Daniel had to reach for that with both hands. What would go through a normal person's mind at a point like this? Daniel was cast into the den of lions. He wasn't sent out into the forest amongst the wild animals. Oh, you might get in trouble if you run into a bear or a lion. This was with intent. This was a cage full of hungry, ornery, waiting, anticipating beasts that Daniel was thrown into. They had to roll a stone in front of it in order to, yes, keep Daniel from getting out, to keep the lions from getting out too. That was their plaything. That was their gladiator situation, if you will. The lions probably wouldn't have had the chance to kill most people, because our hearts would have simply stopped beating as we were let down into that. But not Daniel. I told you earlier about the songs I remember from my childhood, and there was one about Moses. Go down, Moses. And there was one about Samson. And there was one about David. And there was one about Daniel. And it talks about the king, and it says, Daniel, oh Daniel, he said, I'm not afraid of any living creature that the mighty Lord has made. The lion is my brother, that's what the Bible tells. Move over, brother lion, and I know we'll both sleep well. What a great picture. You know, we're going to read in a moment what it says. It says that God shut the lion's mouth, but he did more than that. And again, we need to sit, and we need to think, and we need to consider so that we understand the richness of the story. Daniel, instead of cowering and whimpering in some corner, I expect reached out and put his hand on the back of that lion, probably like this, and stretched out next to him to sleep, like your son or daughter might stretch out and snuggle up to the family dog. You know, he said, I'm not afraid of anything that the Lord has made. He stretched out next to the king of beasts, like your child would with a family dog. Daniel trusted that he was in no danger. Now, the king was a little less confident. It says that he fasted and he prayed all night. It said sleep wouldn't come to him. And at first light, he hurried to the lion's den. Verse 20 says, and when he came to the den, he cried with a lamenting voice. He wasn't real secure on what he was going to see or what he was going to hear. The king spoke, saying to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lion? He called with a question, with concern. Verse 21, and Daniel said to the king, O king, live forever. My God has sent his angel and shut the lion's mouth so that they have not hurt me, because I was found innocent before him. And also, O king, I have done no wrong before you. Again, it says here that he shut up the lion's mouth, but he did more than that. You know, you can picture from that, you might think, okay, well, God put this invisible muzzle on the lion. But the lion's nature, you know, I mean, they kept these things hungry. This was their entertainment. And so the lion's nature, even if he couldn't open his gums, would have been to pounce on something that had been put there, to tear it to shreds, to wait for that super glue to wear off so that he could have dinner. It's not just that the mouth was closed up. God flipped the switch. He took the nature out of these beasts that exists today, existed in that day, and for a moment in time, for 6 hours or 12 hours, he gave Daniel a sense of what the kingdom's going to be like when that lion doesn't have the desire to pounce and to prey upon something else. Verse 23, so again, we see the trust of Daniel. He said, he's closed up my mouth, and no harm has come to me. I've not been scratched. The lion didn't roll over and break my arm during the night. No harm has come to me despite one of the worst possible scenarios that man can devise for the people they hate. Verse 23, then the king was exceedingly glad for him and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken out of the den and no injury whatever was found on him because he believed in God. You know, I'm sure the king ran right over to him and he started, really? Sure. Are you? Yeah. No scratches, no blood, no nothing. Wow. And the king gave the command, verse 24, and they brought these men who had accused Daniel, and they cast them and their families into the den of lions. And it says that the lions instantly, the switch had been flipped one more time, because it says before the bodies could even hit the bottom of the den, the lions were on them and having lunch. Verse 25. Then King Darius wrote to all peoples, all nations and languages that dwell in all the earth. So he sent out a communication as far as he could possibly send it. He peppered the kingdom and the neighboring kingdoms with it, saying, peace be multiplied to you. Verse 26, I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men must tremble and fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God and steadfast forever. His kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall endure to the end. Verse 27, he delivers and he rescues, and he works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. That power, that situation, that den of lions was something that people could relate to. They'd seen it. They'd heard of it. Perhaps they had witnessed at certain times, as we see the Colosseum and we see the gladiators and the slaves being released and the lions and the tigers being sent out. They had seen those grisly details. They understood it. And now they get this letter from the king that certainly everybody paid attention to. And they said, wow, this guy survived with not a scratch. Verse 28, so this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Brethren, what is God teaching us when he includes these stories in the pages of our Bible? In verse 26 and 27, I think, is the culmination of it. Verse 26 and 27, King Darius is inspired to send a message throughout all the land telling of what Daniel knew and trusted that God would do. Let's go back and read verses 26 and 27. Darius says, I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men must tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God. You know, forget the laws that I made. Forget the idols that we set up and the fact that everybody was supposed to worship me. Boy, was I a fool. For he is the living God and steadfast forever. His kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall endure to the end. That sets the stage of who God is. Verse 27, and here's what he does. Here's what he did for Daniel. I saw this. This is going in the history books. He delivers and he rescues. And he works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. He puts that little stamp right on the end of that decree. Say, you know, this is not something I dreamed up at night. This was an event that brought me to a greater degree of faith, to understand who God is, and therefore, you all are going to pay attention. If God can stop the mouths of hungry lions, then he certainly can deliver us from the more common things that we face in our lives. You know, the stories in the Bible, we often see them as wonderful, as miraculous. But God is no less interested in delivering us from the daily challenges that we face. God's not out looking for the headlines. He's not looking for just the big public newsworthy items here. God wants us to understand just how able He is. Remember that the definition of trust? It's the assured confidence in the character, the capability, or the truth of something or someone. God wants us to understand just how capable, just how able He is to take care of us, and that we should, that should give us the security. Remember, it also talked about the security, the confidence, the refuge, and the ability to dispel the anxiety when we feel it. In God we trust. If we live our lives that way, He is pleased to keep His promises. Write down 1 Peter 5 and verse 6. 1 Peter verse 5, or chapter 5 and verse 6 and 7. It tells us, therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that He may exalt you in due time. Daniel was in a situation where he was humbled. He was at risk. And yet God chose to exalt him, to glorify Himself, to lead to a decree that went to all the land and got written in the pages of the Bible to help us understand that the things that we face require trust. Verse 7 says, casting all your care upon Him, for He cares for you. Verse 7 doesn't say that our lives have to be threatened by giants or lions before God will intervene on our behalf. As our Father in heaven, it simply says that He cares for us, for you and for me. As a parent, we're willing to rock our sleepless children to sleep, you know, when they've had a bad dream or their tummy doesn't feel good. We don't only step in front of them when it's a newsworthy item. We extract slivers from toes. We cool a feverish forehead. Verse 7 says that God cares for us, regardless of how large or so small our trials turn out to be. In Jeremiah 49 and verse 11, we're told that God cares for the fatherless children and that our widows can trust in Him as well. Again, not just bears and lions and giants, but everyday lives, everyday Christians. Brethren, we're also told that there are many things that we should not trust or depend on. Please write this group down. Just write these scriptures and you can refer to them later. You know them. I'll refer to them very quickly. But Psalm chapter 44 and verse 6. Psalm 44 verse 6 says, for I will trust not in my bow, neither in my sword to save me. Remember what David said? I haven't proven these. The other guy has a faster bow, a bigger gun, a sharper sword. I'm trusting in God. Psalm 49 and verse 6. They that trust in their wealth and boast themselves in the multitude of their riches will come to nothing. So not our bow, not our sword, not our wealth. Psalm chapter 118, verses 8 and 9. Psalm 118, verse 8 and 9. It is better to trust in the Lord than to put confidence in man. Your employer, your brother, your neighbor. Verse 9, it is better to trust in the Lord than to put confidence in princes. Is the mayor going to do something for you? Are the police going to take care of you? It's better to trust in God. Isaiah 31 and verse 1. It says, woe to them that go down to Egypt for help and stay on horses and trust in chariots because they are many and in horsemen because they're very strong. But they look not unto the Holy One of Israel, neither seek the Lord. So, brethren, we're told not to trust in certain things, not to feel 10'6" tall, but to trust in God. Not long ago, I had the opportunity to watch the most recent of the Transformer movies. I don't know if you've a fan of the Transformers. There's three movies. I don't remember what the name of it is, but it was the most recent of the Transformers movie. And at the end of the movie, after an intense battle with the Decepticons, Optimus Prime stands victorious alongside these brave and yet fragile human beings that he feels a protector of. And he gives a short speech that's meant to be inspiring. It's meant to build confidence and to dispel anxiety. And he says, in any war, there are calms between storms. There will be days when we lose faith, days when our allies turn against us. But the day will never come when we forsake this planet and its people. And I couldn't help but recognize that they had plagiarized that speech. You see, God made that promise long ago in Hebrews chapter 13. In Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 5, he tells us that I will never fail you nor forsake you. And verse 6 says, and so we can confidently say, we can trust in that promise. We can confidently say, the Lord is my helper, and I will not be afraid. Brethren, as impressive as this 50-foot-tall, high-tech, shiny robot with all its weapons were, if he were real, he doesn't hold a candle to our Almighty God in heaven. God tells us that he cares for those that seek him. He delivers those that call on him. He promises that he will be there for us in our times of need. And we can come to trust in him, and we need to come to trust in him, as if our very lives depend on it.